Okay, hi guys, I'm Claire, and I'll be reading the Bible for us tonight. Tonight's Bible reading comes from Esther chapter 5, beginning at verse 9, and goes until chapter 7, verse 10, and it's on page 496 of the Pew Bibles. So it's Esther chapter 5, beginning at verse 9, on page 496. Haman went out that day happy and in high spirits. But when he saw Mordecai at the king's gate and observed that he neither rose nor showed fear in his presence, he was filled with rage against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home. Calling together his friends and Zeresh his wife, Haman boasted to them about his vast wealth, his many sons, and all the ways the king had honored him and how he had elevated him above the other nobles and officials. And that's not all, Haman added. I'm the only person Queen Esther invited to accompany the king to the banquet she gave. And she has invited me along with the king tomorrow. But all this gives me no satisfaction as long as I see that Jew Mordecai sitting at the king's gate. His wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, have a pole set up, reaching to a height of 50 cubits, and ask the king in the morning to have Mordecai impaled on it. Then go with the king to the banquet and enjoy yourself. This suggestion delighted Haman, and he had the pole set up. That night the king could not sleep, so he ordered the book of the Chronicles, the record of his reign, to be brought in and read to him. It was found recorded there that Mordecai had exposed Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's officers who guarded the doorway, who had conspired to assassinate King Xerxes. What honor and recognition has Mordecai received for this? The king asked. Nothing has been done for him, his attendants answered. The king said, who is in the court? Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the palace to speak to the king about impaling Mordecai on the pole he had set up for him. His attendants answered, Haman is standing in the court. Bring him in, the king ordered. When Haman entered, the king asked him, what should be done for the man the king delights to honor? Now Haman thought to himself, who is there that the king would rather honor than me? So he answered the king, for the man the king delights to honor, have them bring a royal robe the king has worn and a horse the king has ridden, one with a royal crest placed on its head. Then let the robe and horse be entrusted to one of the king's most noble princes. Let them robe the man the king delights to honor and lead him on the horse through the city streets, proclaiming before him, this is what is done for the man the king delights to honor. Go at once, the king commanded Haman. Get the robe and the horse and do just as you have suggested for Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. Do not neglect anything you have recommended. So Haman got the robe and the horse. He robed Mordecai and led him on horseback through the city streets, proclaiming before him, this is what is done for the man the king delights to honor. Afterward, Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman rushed home with his head covered in grief and told Zeresh his wife and all his friends everything that had happened to him. His advisers and his wife Zeresh said to him, since Mordecai, before whom your downfall has started, is of Jewish origin, you cannot stand against him. You will surely come to ruin. But while they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried Haman away to the banquet Esther had prepared. So the king and Haman went to Queen Esther's banquet, and as they were drinking wine on the second day, the king again asked, Queen Esther, what is your petition? It will be given to you. What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it will be granted. Then Queen Esther answered, if I have found favor with you, your majesty, and if it pleases you, grant me my life. This is my petition. And spare my people. This is my request. For I and my people have been sold to be destroyed, killed, and annihilated. If we had merely been sold as male and female slaves, I would have kept quiet, because no such distress would justify disturbing the king. King Xerxes asked Queen Esther, who is he? Where is he, the man who has dared to do such a thing? Esther said, an adversary, an enemy, this vile Haman. Then Haman was terrified before the king and queen. The king got up in rage, left his wine, and went out into the palace garden. But Haman, realizing that the king had already decided his fate, stayed behind to beg Queen Esther for his life. Just as the king returned from the palace garden to the banquet hall, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was reclining. The king exclaimed, "Will he even molest the queen while she is with me in the house?" As soon as the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs attending the king, said, "A pole reaching to a height of 50 cubits stands by Haman's house. He had set it up for Mordecai, who spoke up to help the king." The king said, "Impale him on it." So they impaled Haman on the pole he had set up for Mordecai. Then the king's fury subsided. This is the word of the Lord.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to church tonight. My name's Al, and I want to welcome you, especially if you're not normally here on a Sunday night. As far as I can tell, there's a few people who have dropped in for the evening. I'm really glad you're here, and really looking forward to hearing what God's Word has to say to you and to us tonight. For a few weeks now, we've been looking at the book of Esther, and it takes us to an unfamiliar setting, even for people who are familiar with the Bible generally, because the events of the book of Esther are not set in Jerusalem. They're not even set in the land of Israel. They're set in a far eastern capital of the Persian Empire, about 5 centuries before Jesus. And as we read through the book, we find it's a brutal and irreligious culture, an extremely hostile environment to be in for people of faith, if I can use that label, like the Jews that we meet. And Esther's claim to fame as a book, which has been mentioned a couple of times already, is that God is never mentioned. God is never mentioned. And to my mind, this is the key to its value, because it forces a discipline on us as we read it. It disciplines us with the question, what does it mean for people who know God is real to deal with the daily material and relational realities in a world that thinks God isn't real and where God isn't always apparent? What does it mean to do that? And isn't this the world we live in? You wake up in the morning, you say your prayers, your head is full of God. 4 hours later, where are you? You're in a classroom. You're in a sales meeting. You're populating a spreadsheet. Where is God? What does it mean to live in that space as someone who believes there's more to reality than can be seen, but who has to operate in the seen reality? And today in particular, we're going to reflect on the theme of power and what the book of Esther has to teach us about that. It's a very topical subject, isn't it? In the last couple of years, I suppose, our culture has really been perplexed by the way that power so easily spins out of control in toxic ways. The Me Too movement has opened our eyes to terrible abuses of power going on in plain sight and yet somehow not perceived. We're alert to workplace bullying in a way that we haven't been in the past. We're alert to domestic abuse and domestic violence in ways that shock us. Power is something that our society is interested in. And the solution is not just, well, if only everybody could be nicer to one another. That's a good sentiment. But there's something about power and power relationships which has a particular logic and momentum of its own. And I'm going to suggest that the only real solution is the change of heart that Jesus can bring us. The key characters in the story we're going to look at tonight, Esther and Mordecai and Haman, in some ways the biggest contrast between them is the power differences. Esther is called Queen Esther, but the title is purely ornamental. The book opens with her predecessor being done away with at a stroke. So to be queen doesn't really mean that much. In fact, to be queen in some ways demonstrates your powerlessness, because the way Esther got to be queen was by being forcibly removed from her family and brought to serve in the king's sexual harem. She ends up being prominent because she's so beautiful that she serves as eye candy to prove the king's power. She's ornamental. That's Esther. Secondly, Mordecai. Mordecai is Esther's guardian and uncle. And he enters the story because he's an exile of war. We read in chapter 2, if you have Esther open there, chapter 2, verse 5. Now there was in the citadel of Susa a Jew of the tribe of Benjamin named Mordecai, son of Jair, son of Shimei, son of Kish, who, note this, had been carried into exile from Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, among those taken captive with Jehoiachin, king of Judah. He's completely powerless. He's only there because he was taken captive, and he kind of lurks on the fringes of the palace precinct because of his anxiety about his niece, Esther, who's been kidnapped and made queen. But then thirdly and finally, we meet Haman, who's a senior noble and is a man of almost unfettered power. We're introduced to him at the start of chapter 3. After these events, chapter 3, verse 1, King Xerxes honoured Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, elevating him and giving him a seat of honour higher than that of all the other nobles. In other words, he is second in the empire only to the king. It goes on, all the royal officials at the king's gate knelt down and paid honour to Haman, for the king had commanded this concerning him. But Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honour. A man of immense power. And so we're set up to consider the power dynamics there. You might have heard the very famous quote, it's almost a cliche actually, power corrupts. I think the original is power tends to corrupt. It's a well-known saying and it resonates with something, but actually I think it's too optimistic, don't you? To say power corrupts suggests that I'm uncorrupted. And when I get in a position of power, I'm somehow transformed from being an uncorrupted person to being a corrupted person. Of course that's not true. I'm already corrupt. And so are you. I'm already intensely committed to myself as a top of my priority list. Power doesn't create that. What power does is it reveals. Power doesn't corrupt. Power reveals. It reveals my passionate self-commitment by removing the constraints that are normally in the way, like other people. And the effect of power in particular, I think, is to give rein in our lives to three lies. If you're taking notes, you might want to write these three lies down. You see this in powerful people. Firstly, the lie that I matter more. Power makes us believe I matter more. Secondly, the lie that I know best. I matter more, I know best. And thirdly, the lie that I'm in control. You see all of these in Haman in abundance. Let's think about each of these. Firstly, the lie that I matter more. Power makes people just believe that they count. That they count. Power makes people believe they deserve a parking spot close to the entrance. Power makes people believe they deserve to get off the plane first. Power makes people believe that they are somehow more real than other people, more alive than other people, more important than other people. There are examples everywhere, but I don't know if you've heard of the Hollywood producer, Scott Rudin. This guy just churns out hits, everything from Zoolander to Lady Bird. Just for 20 years or more, he's just been churning out blockbusters. And it turns out he's not just movies, he's stage. In fact, I want to get this right, he's the only producer ever to have won an Emmy, a Grammy, an Oscar, and a Tony Award. I mean, this guy has the Midas touch. According to the Wall Street, so he's immensely powerful, right, in Hollywood, in the entertainment industry. According to the Wall Street Journal, between 2000 and 2005, Scott Rudin fired 250 personal assistants. That's a lot of personal assistants to go through, including one whom he fired for bringing him the wrong flavored breakfast muffin. And when the journalist put this accusation to him, you know, he said, "I don't remember that, but it sounds plausible." Now, this is the work of someone who just somehow thinks he matters more than these people. These are real people who've got their dream job, personal assistant to Scott Rudin, the most successful producer in Hollywood, 250 of them. See, power makes people believe I matter more. And you see this in Haman. If you have Esther open, I hope you do. You look at chapter 3, the start of it, it's fantastic. We hear chapter 3, verse 2, all the royal officials at the king's gate knelt down and paid honour to Haman, for the king had commanded this concerning him, but Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honour. Then the royal officials at the king's gate asked Mordecai, "Why do you disobey the king's command?" Day after day they spoke to him, but he refused to comply. Therefore, they told Haman about it. This is plotting and scheming and trying to get one up over there. They told Haman about it to see whether Mordecai's behavior would be tolerated. For he had told them he was a Jew, which sounds like that's in some part the reason that he wasn't bowing down. Verse 5. When Haman saw that Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor, he was enraged. Yet, having learned who Mordecai's people were, he scorned the idea of killing only Mordecai. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes. That's incredible, isn't it? He just matters more. If he's offended, it's not enough even to take his revenge on one person. If he's offended, that legitimizes genocide, just because he matters more. Who are the Jews after all? It's like Scott Rudin. Who are these PAs, you know? The myth that I matter more, the lie that I matter more. I read a lot of management literature. And it talks about power poisoning. The lie that I matter more. And in fact, in this short book, there are so many examples from Haman. There's a great one. Midway through chapter 6, we heard in our Bible reading, chapter 6, verse 6. When Haman entered the court, the king asked him, "What should be done for the man the king delights to honour?" Now Haman thought to himself, "Who is there that the king would rather honour than me?" I mean, it's obvious. He must be talking about me, right? Because I matter more than everybody else. It wouldn't occur to the king to honour anybody else. It goes on. "Who is it the king would want to honour more than me?" So he answered the king, "For the man the king delights to honour, have them bring a royal robe." He's really setting himself up for this immense honour. "Have them bring a royal robe that the king has worn and a horse the king has ridden, one with a royal crest placed on its head, and then let the robe and the horse be entrusted to one of the king's most noble princes." He's thinking, who are my rivals? Get one of them to have to lead me on the king's horse. It's so great. Have them entrusted to one of the king's most noble princes, verse 9. Let the robe the man the king delights to honour. Let them robe the man the king delights to honour, and let them lead him on the horse through the city streets, proclaiming before him, "This is what is done for the man the king delights to honour." The king loves this idea. "Go at once," the king commanded Haman. "Get the robe and the horse and do just as you have suggested for Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate." The point is, he's powerful. Haman is so powerful, he's the king's 2IC, and he just believes he matters more. He matters more. But there's a second lie, the lie that I know best. We all go through life assuming that we're right, whether we're powerful or not. We just think we're right. That's our default setting. But the more powerful you are, the harder it is to believe that you're wrong. It's as if having power just turns down the volume on everybody else's opinions and turns up the volume on yours. It becomes harder and harder to accept the advice of others. We hear it every day. Bosses who make bad business calls talk about their gut instinct, ignore the advice of those around them. Sports people who just can't believe their day has come. They can't believe they'll ever be dropped. They just keep going on in the face of advice. Politicians who believe they've got their finger on the pulse, the people around them. Should I change mics, Toby?
How's that? Lovely. Politicians who just believe nobody would ever vote against me. You know, they ignore the advice of those around them. I was reading an HBR article this week that talked about bosses who suffer from chronic certainty. Chronic certainty. This is the lie that I know best. And Haman is conspicuous in the book of Esther for always believing that he's the smartest guy in the room. He's too powerful to hear advice. In fact, in a slightly tragic moment, this is in chapter 6 if you've got it there, while plotting Mordecai's death, Haman is given potentially life-saving advice. And it's by the people closest to him who love him the best. Look at chapter 6 and verse 12. Haman rushed home with his head covered in grief, and he told Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends everything that had happened to him, how this terrible mistake had happened. He'd end up leading the horse for someone else, right? His advisors and his wife, Zeresh, said to him, "Since Mordecai, before whom your downfall has started, is of Jewish origin, you cannot stand against him. You will surely come to ruin." It's wasted on him. It's wasted on him. He thinks he knows best. That's the second lie. The third lie is the lie that I'm in control. And again, the examples are so obvious. This is what the Me Too movement's all about. People who are so powerful, they just can't imagine any adverse effect from anything they do. They just feel like they're running things. There's no such thing in their head as unforeseen consequences. They just think they're in control. And this is the case, as I say, tragically for Haman. We've been reading the book, so we know things he doesn't. We know there are important developments taking place that are beyond his knowledge and beyond his control. We know, and he does not, that Mordecai's intelligence has saved the king's life. We know, and he does not, that Queen Esther's banquet is a trap. But he's convinced he's in control. Which is why in chapter 5 and verse 10, it says, calling together his friends and Zeresh, his wife, Haman boasted to them about his vast wealth, his many sons, all the ways the king had honored him and how he had elevated him above all the other nobles and officials. That's not all, Haman added. I'm the only person Queen Esther invited to accompany the king to the banquet she gave, and she has invited me along with the king tomorrow. It's a trap. But he believes he's in control. It doesn't enter his head there might be more going on here that he's aware of. Now, here's the thing. It's fascinating to see this ancient example of power poisoning. But this is not just ancient Persian nobles. And it's not just Hollywood heavyweights. To an extent, this is true in our normal everyday workplaces. I came across a study this week. This was a study done in the UK by academic psychologists. And they compared a group of senior business managers to three groups of psychiatric patients, including some of those patients who had been placed in psychiatric detention in the UK. Let me read just some of the results. Compared to the three patient samples, the senior business manager group is more likely to demonstrate the traits associated with histrionic personality disorder, and equally likely to demonstrate the traits associated with narcissistic and compulsive personality disorders. These are senior business managers, right? These are people who are not regarded as suffering any sort of psychiatric illness. It says, what does this actually mean? At a descriptive level, so this is what you're seeing the senior business managers, this translates to superficial charm, insincerity, egocentricity, manipulativeness, grandiosity, a lack of empathy, exploitativeness, narcissistic independence, perfectionism, excessive devotion to work, rigidity, stubbornness, and dictatorial tendencies. These are senior business managers in the UK. Now, what about you? What about you? Let me tell you this. You have power. You have power in some setting. You have power if you have a younger sibling. You have power if you're a kids ministry or a youth ministry leader. You have power if you go to work and there are people who work under you. You have power if there's someone who's romantically attracted to you and you're not attracted to them. You have power if you have wealth. There'll be contexts in your life where you have power, where you are the little Haman. And your power will reveal your tendency in that setting to believe that you matter more and that you know best and that you're in control. This is true of me. Now, it's worth just pausing and saying, so what? I mean, if these senior business managers were confronted with this data, they'd say, well, so what? I'm taking home the $400,000 pay packet. Does it matter? If I've got what you call power poison, you know it matters. You know that it matters. Nobody believes that. Nobody believes, oh, well, whatever. That's why we're horrified by that story about Scott Rudin firing some poor schmuck for bringing the wrong muffin. We just think, that's not okay. We're not saying that because we're Christians. This was in the Wall Street Journal. We dread having a psycho boss. We know that this is out of step. You don't even need to be a Christian to know this. We know this, that sort of power is out of step with something bigger and more profound about life and humanity and value and purpose and joy and flourishing. That sort of power poisoning, I matter more, I know best, I'm control. We know that is bad. And the gospel of Jesus actually tells us something even worse. It tells us not that that's out of step with human flourishing, it's out of step with God himself and his heart. And therefore, catastrophic. And you see this play out dramatically, of course, in the book of Esther, as we heard in our Bible reading. It's interesting, you contrast Esther with Haman in the book. And you think about those three lies. Esther does not believe that she matters more. In fact, chapter 4 and verse 15, when Esther is agonizing over what to do about Haman's decision to slaughter the Jews, we read this. Mordecai advises her. Esther sent this reply to Mordecai. Go gather all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my attendants will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. What is she doing there? I'll tell you what she's doing there. She is saying, not I matter more. The lives of people less powerful than I am matter more than my life. That's what she's doing there. It's the opposite of I matter more. It's I matter less, they matter more. She also doesn't just believe that she knows best. One of the interesting things in the book of Esther is how much advice is given by various characters to other characters. But again, chapter 4, this time verse 12, Esther's words were reported to Mordecai. He sent back this answer. Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. If you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this. This is unwelcome advice for Esther. It's saying you can't keep your head down and just enjoy your palace life. She accepts it. She doesn't think she knows best. She hears this advice. She thinks, it's not what I was going to do, but it's what I'm going to do. And finally, she doesn't believe that she's in control. That's why she says to her uncle, get everybody to fast, because there's more going on than meets the eye. Make them fast for 3 days. Something is happening beyond my immediate actions, which are going to have a bearing on this outcome. And the result of that is a vindication that no individual in the story could ever have seen coming. Haman, the second most powerful man in the empire, is executed on the gallows that he built for his enemy, Mordecai. Executed. Esther and her people are honored and protected. You don't see it coming, but there it is. The power poisoning proves catastrophic. Well, that's the story in the book of Esther, but how does that help us directly? How do we escape power poisoning? You in your positions of power, how can you be transformed to be less like Haman and more like Esther? I'll tell you what the answer is not. The answer is not just by thinking hard about it. The answer is not by doing an MBA and taking a module called servant leadership. That's not the answer. The answer, as I said at the start, is the difference that Jesus makes in a person's heart and in a person's life. Now, why is that? I'll tell you why. Because in the gospel, you encounter someone immensely powerful. Jesus is the single most powerful person who has ever walked on this earth on which we live. Immensely powerful. Listen to this from the start of the Gospel of John. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. In him was life, and that life was the light of all mankind. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. Here's the point. In Jesus you find someone who actually does matter more. You find someone who actually does know best. You find someone who actually is in control. Not the lie that we believe, it is true of Jesus. And what does he do with his power? You read on. He was in the world. And though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize him. He came to that which was his own. His own did not receive him. Yet to all who did receive him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. Children born not of natural descent or human decision or a husband's will, but born of God. Jesus comes into a world of little Hamans, of whom you are one, Haman. Jesus comes into a world of little Hamans, and he acts not in power, but in humility and in love. And for your sake, Haman, Jesus says not, I matter more, but your life will matter more than mine. For your sake, Haman, Jesus submits not to his own will, I know best, but to another's will. Father, not my will, but yours be done. For your sake, Haman, Jesus says not, I must be in control, but places his life in the hands of his enemies. And yet, in a miracle of God's grace, at the end of the story, it is not you, Haman, but Jesus who is impaled on the gallows. Now, when you see Jesus hanging on the cross, you are looking at a person of immense power, not denying his power, but using it to save you. I mean, this is incredible. We look at that, we start to see something about ourselves, about where real power is to be found and how real power should be used. And the risen Jesus says this: forget the lie that you matter more. You do matter. Not because you have power, says Jesus, but because I love you and value you. You don't have to believe the lie that you know best, because you can trust me. You can trust my purpose in your life. You don't need to be in control, because I'm in control and I will never fail you. And so I ask you, will you abandon your power in those settings where you have power? Will you abandon your power, abandon your pride, surrender to him? Or will you hold out like Haman? To repent and to follow Jesus will not only save your life, but it will make you a better sibling. It'll make you a more trustworthy manager. It'll make you a kinder leader. To be a disciple is to be small. It's to look not down on others, but to look up to Jesus. Amen.